From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm David Andrietta, in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made about 2 weeks ago with the publication of a jaw-dropping, eye-opening report that found deeds for private and public properties across a large swath of Monroe County at one time legally barred non-white people from buying or leasing them. That housing developers, realtors, and bankers had written these restrictive racial covenants into land deeds for decades in our communities and communities like it across the United States has been well documented. What wasn't known until now was the pervasiveness of these covenants in our area, and in what was a shock to many people who read the report, that they still exist. They're still on the books. Although the covenants are no longer enforceable and haven't been for some time, they shape the Monroe County we know today. The divisions we see in our community are in part a direct result of these covenants and the destructive impact they had on the prospects for upward mobility of people of color for so long is, in a word, incalculable. Folks, you've heard a lot about structural racism in recent years, particularly the last few months. Some people still struggle to understand what that is exactly. If you're one of them, look no further. These covenants are the epitome of structural racism. So what is to be done about these covenants? Should anything be done about them at this point? Can anything be done? Lots of questions to answer, and to help us do that are my guests. Joining me this hour, Shane Wiegand, a board member with the Rochester-based City Roots Community Land Trust, one of the organizations that conducted the racial covenant study. Welcome, Shane.
David, thanks so much for having me on. It's an honor to be here.
I got it. Connor Dwyer Reynolds is joining us. He's a clinical lecturer at Yale Law School and co-director of the school's Environmental Protection Clinic and a lead researcher on the study. Thank you for joining us, Connor.
It's wonderful to be here.
And also with us is Kevin Beckford, who wears a lot of hats. He's a member of the Pittsford Town Board, who has pushed for greater emphasis on inclusive and equitable housing in the town, and as a member of the Rochester Anti-Racism Action Coalition, was also involved in the development of the Covenant Report. Kevin, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
As always, we invite you, the listener, to call in with questions or to share your thoughts. And I want to do that right at the top of the hour here. We might not be able to get to your calls right away, but we will in good time. Perhaps you have one of these covenants in your deed. What was your reaction when you discovered it? What, if anything, did you do about it? Did you decide not to buy the home? If you had the deed revised, what was the process? If you're listening and you live in a home that's 75 years or older, chances are good you have one of these restrictive clauses in your deed. We want to hear from you. The phone lines are the phone number to call is 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. Or you can always email the program at connections@wxxi.org. Now, before we launch into a discussion of the covenants and the report, I want to open with some introductions because I think it's important that listeners have a sense of who was behind the study and how it all came together. We've got a land trust in Rochester, Yale University. We're talking about Monroe County. It's not clear how the dots are connected here. So, Shane, I'd like to begin with you because listeners might recognize your name. You've earned a lot of media coverage, including in the publication I Edit, City, for your work on anti-racist curriculum that's gaining traction in Monroe County school districts. But you also sit on the board of the City Roots Community Land Trust. Tell us a little bit more about the land trust, what it is and what it does, and how it became involved in this project.
Thanks, David. So City Roots Community Land Trust, it's a group of neighbors that really kind of began in the Beechwood and Plymouth Exchange neighborhoods, previously redlined, disinvested neighborhoods, where neighbors came together, majority low-income neighbors, people of color, who said, like, we're having problems with gentrification in our neighborhood. We want permanently affordable land, and we want it to be community controlled. We want to have a say over where we live, because for so long we haven't. And through that work, I got to meet many activists, former members of FIGHT and at NAACP in Rochester, who have been fighting this fight for years. And the Land Trust was formed through their efforts, and I got invited to be a part of it. And through that, I started learning about racial deed restrictions. And actually uncovered that in Beechwood, we have quite a few racial deed restrictions in what's the whitest part of our neighborhood, in that Bay and Culver section of the neighborhood.
And it, remains the whitest part of the neighborhood.
It means the whitest.
No, it remains the whitest.
Right? Oh, it remains the whitest.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And so that history really helped inform some of this work. but it also drove the questions I was getting in my classroom from my fourth graders. And so the two things really went well together. And I was able to share what I was learning with my fourth graders and what I was learning with my fourth graders with the people in the community, and really became a really special thing. And that's how I met Connor and Kevin through all of this work.
So again, how did it become involved in the project? I mean, who's the lead on this project, if you will? Is it Yale?
I would say City Roots Community Land Trust has been the lead on this project in partnership directly with Yale. We couldn't do the research that Yale was able to do, combing the whole country, pulling the stuff together. Connor and his students did an incredible job. But previously to that, myself and my students had done years of work uncovering thousands of racial deed restrictions that I think helped pave the way for Connor and his team to just really knock this report out of the park and make it something that more people could have access to.
So, Connor, let's turn to you then. What does the Environmental Protection Clinic at Yale Law School have to do with racist covenants in Monroe County? How do the two fit together? What did you set out to accomplish with this study?
Well, a couple of things. First, it's a common part of the American environmental movement that it's often, you know, seen as being led by white people for white people and focusing on, you know, movements and positions that benefit white people. But in reality, the long history of the environmental movement in the United States is all about people of color and poor people fighting to have equitable and healthy environments for themselves. And so a big part of what Yale's Environmental Protection Clinic tries to do is work on efforts, including land use policies, that get racial equity for folks. And so, you know, this partnership working with City Roots lines up with the clinic's mission pretty well. And so, you know, as Shane said, you know, we followed on to his team's work. And when we decided to have this partnership, and I want to call out the students, Regina Harlig, Alex Misko, Aaron Troncoso, who really worked their butts off on this report, as well as City Roots attorney Jim Pergolizzi. You know, we came together and then we said, you know, we're going to do this, but we want to hear what folks in the community, what they want out of this report. And that's how we linked up with Kevin and a lot of other community members. And what they told us was, look, Shane's got this great set of history. We want to know who did this, how extensive it was, and maybe most importantly, what can be done about it. And that's what is wrapped up in the report. It gets to all those points. And I'm happy to talk about specifically what racial covenants are and what deeds are and all these things. I'm sure a lot of listeners don't quite know that.
We will get to all of that, including who did it, how expensive it was. So thank you for that summation. Now, the report is called Confronting Racial Covenants, How They Segregated Monroe County, and What to Do About Them. It's 58 pages long. It is eye-opening. I encourage anyone who wants to better understand the community they live in and what it looks like today to take a look at this report. I know there has been some media coverage of this, including in City, including in the Democrat and Chronicle. Both of those articles link to the report. The report can be found. Where's the easiest place to find it, Connor? Because I'm at a Yale Law School website right now, and it's sort of a long URL for people to follow. So, what's the easiest way to get to it?
Type into your Google search or wherever the search bar is in your web browsers, Yale Confronting Racial Covenants, or just Yale Racial Covenants. It's going to be one of the first links you pop up to is the press release, and the press release right at the top has a link to the report. So just Google those three or four words, and that's a quick way to get to the report.
Very good. And Megan Mack, producer, just informed me that we will also link to it on our podcast page. Which will be coming up later today. So 58 pages. It can be found online at Yale Law School's webpage. As Connor said, a simple Google search ought to get you there. The title, Confronting Racial Covenants. Why is it important to confront them, and why now?
Well, look, first, I want to make sure people understand what racial covenants are. These were agreements between neighbors that banned black and brown people from living in a neighborhood. Some of these covenants also apply to other folks, Italian people, Polish people, immigrants, and Jewish people. But they really focused on black and brown people. These agreements usually appeared in the property deeds that transferred ownership from a home from person to person. If you ever bought or sold a home, you're familiar with these things. But what a deed is it just transfers the document that gets filed at the Monroe County Clerk's office that shows that the legal powers over home ownership transferring from one person to another. And as part of these deeds, part of American property law allows people to insert restrictions into these deeds that don't just apply to the homeowner buying the new home, but they can apply to every homeowner that buys that home in the future.
From what I read, though, Connor, that these covenants weren't necessarily buried in the fine print. They seemed pretty user-friendly, if you will. They were easy to find in the deed. I mean, a deed is actually typically a short document anyway.
That's right. These deeds are about a page or two long, and I'm gonna quote from a cover the kind of language that was typical in deeds that they included racial covenants. Here it is.
You're ahead of me, but I'm glad we're going down this road. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, these deeds usually said, quote, "This land is sold on the express covenant that it shall never be occupied by a colored person." And oftentimes it wasn't the words colored person being used. It was words I wouldn't say on the air.
Sure.
And so it was clear. It was straightforward and it was simple. You didn't need to be a lawyer to understand what was happening when one of these things was in your deed. And I also want to make clear what it means that these things were enforceable. If someone decided to sell their home, trying to sell their home to a black or brown person, neighbors could sue that person, bring them to court, and sue to either cancel the agreement to sell the home, or they could sue the oath breaker for a lot of money. And so these racial covenants were extremely effective. And they weren't just enforceable in court. They were enforceable as social agreements. And neighbors really took these things seriously. And so if someone on their block was even thinking about selling a home to a black or brown person, the whole neighborhood often came together and harassed and socially ostracized the person who thought about selling their home. So these things, when we say that they're enforceable, we say they were very effective.
Out of curiosity, this is for anyone on the panel who would like to take it, did you ever delve into whether these covenants were enforced and how they were enforced, like whether neighbors did sue other neighbors in court? I wonder if that can be traced.
So I can take that question.
Sure.
Just because it's kind of the research my students did. So across New York State, there are many examples, many court cases where people did sue in court. We don't know if that happened in Rochester. We'd have to do some pretty extensive legal research to figure that out here. But what we do know happened in Rochester is that kind of social enforcement, that harassment, that saying, "I'm not going to sell the home to you because you're a black person and because there's this deed and I just can't do it." That happened all the time. And there's a whole neighborhoods across Monroe County that were famous for people enforcing these things, including the 19th Ward in the city.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about the history of these things? Because they're no longer enforceable. When did they start to rear their head, and when did they begin to phase out? Shane, do you want to take that?
Sure. I think kind of the early 1900s, 1910, 1920 is when we really see these start getting huge in our community. Eastman Kodak and building Meadowbrook in Brighton really paved the way in Rochester, putting those on racial restrictions against black people moving there on hundreds of homes right next to Brighton High School.
What was happening at that point in our history?
Oh, I mean, we've got the resurgence of the Klan. This is when Birth of a Nation is coming out. This is when people are really concerned about, people of color moving into their neighborhoods.
Right. But we're also seeing a migration, right, of black people from the South.
The first wave of migration, and the first wave of the Great Migration is beginning. That's something we teach in fourth grade. Rochester, though, had a very small first wave. We had between 5,000 and 10,000 people of color at that period of time. So there wasn't really even a huge risk of integration happening in our community, and the fear of it happening still. It is really shown in how extensive these covenants were and pervasive throughout our community. And then in 1948, with Shelley versus Kramer, the Supreme Court said you could no longer enforce these, and yet people still enforce them. We know in 1958, the first black judge in Rochester, Reuben Davis, tried to buy a home on Elmdorf Avenue in the 19th Ward. And the woman and the bank, they wouldn't sell him the home because there was a deed restriction on the house saying black people couldn't live there. And so he had to get a white lawyer to buy the home for him and sell it to him under the table. So it was really until wasn't until 1968 that firmly and officially it was no longer legal to really enforce and push these things through.
What happened in 1968? I was under the impression that it was in the 1950s that that there was a hard stop on these. But what happened in 1968?
In 1968, the Fair Housing Act gets passed. And Connor could add a little bit more about that because they're in New York State. It was a little different than other places. So I'll turn it back to you, Connor.
Yeah, briefly, New York passed a law in the early 1960s that made these things illegal. The Fair Housing Act made them illegal in 1968. But there's a difference between it becoming legally unenforceable, which happened in the late 1940s and early 1950s in a pair of Supreme Court cases, and them actually becoming illegal. And the difference is this, is that when they're unenforceable, you can't go to court to sue them, but you can still write them, and they can still be put on government documents. In 1968, that's when it's illegal to write these things, put them on government owned documents at the Monroe County Clerk's Office anymore.
That's got it. And even when they're legally unenforceable and they're on a deed, there's a deterrent effect. There's a shock value to it. A lot of people are unsophisticated. You know, we're not all real estate lawyers. And so when you read this deed, you I'm assuming that there would be people who would just think that, oh, okay, these are the rules I have to live by if I'm going to live here, even though it was legally enforceable.
And the thing is that people do assume that. We have instances of folks in Virginia in the last couple of decades trying to enforce these agreements. So that they still have power even today.
I want to take a call from Rich in Rochester. Rich, thank you for listening.
Hello, how you doing?
We're good here. What did you have to say?
I'm an older black male, getting into my senior years, I guess. And the thing that I'm realizing is how pervasive and how systematic the United States has actually did everything they could to hurt black people. I've always been one who always said reparations makes no sense, but the more I hear about this, the more I think this stuff, I mean, even if I can buy a home in a neighborhood, if I go into a neighborhood as a black man and buy a home, the houses adjacent to me lose value. Just for the simple reason that I'm a black man, even in today's world. From this, you take your farmers' bills, from your Vietnam veterans' bills, from your veterans. There's absolutely nothing that has been given to the people in the United States that has not been kept from black people, not one. Even today, it's anecdotal, but I've talked to black businessmen and women, black business people, the hard time they're getting the money from the government, like every other small businesses, they're not getting the money. This stuff is so pervasive. I think black people with slave heritage, I'm beginning to believe we should do what the Native Americans have done as far as challenging the United States in court on their treaties. We should do the same thing. I mean, it's this frustration that I see that, and all I hear from most white people, look at black people, their own welfare, they're so lazy. And yet their welfare is billions, magnitudes greater than black people have ever gotten from the United States. I'm talking about magnitudes.
Rich,
it's anger.
Rich, thank you so much for the call. I'm going to turn this over to Kevin at this point because I'd like you. You've been an advocate for inclusive and equitable housing in your town and elsewhere. I'd like you to describe for listeners what Rich is talking about here. Rich is saying that there has been a long history of structural racism here, and he's feeling like he is only just discovering that as he's getting into his later years. I think a lot of people are only discovering that right now, including myself. We're all learning as 2020 is unfolding and hopefully learning more into the future. But I'd like you to I want to stick on the topic of racial covenants. So can you help us, Kevin, understand the impacts of covenants like these and what they have meant to our community? Again, Rich, I thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you. And Rich, thank you for, and I just want to really affirm your frustration. I share your frustration. In fact, you know, probably the best fuel for change in Rochester, and actually in most change, but particularly with this issue, is education. And the more that we're able to understand what we did as a country, and very specifically what we did here in Monroe County, is directly connected to the challenges that we are still facing today around systemic poverty, generational wealth gap. And the problem is even bigger than that. I mean, this discussion today is around housing. But the segregation, the mindset that drove the segregation in our housing exists in our workplaces. So it's a very insidious and unfortunately very pervasive problem that will not be able to be changed unless it's faced. Right. And, you know, that's one of the slides from Shane's presentation around, that James Baldwin shared is one of his quotes is that, you know, you can't change these issues if you don't understand it and if you don't face it. And as far as impact, Rich, Pittsburgh is a wonderful example. And I don't mean that in a good way, of where these racial covenants were in place when we went through the majority of our growth. We went from 9,000 houses, or residents, excuse me, to 25,000. We only have 30,000 today, people today. So most of our growth, and at that time, we literally had a sign up that says, no black people can live here. You can't rent. You can't buy. No one can give you the house. And in fact, by the time that it was no longer legal to stop black people from living in Pittsburgh, there was still a mindset associated with that, because you have to keep in mind, in order to believe this, that means you have to believe that people of color are not fully human. That's the only way you can talk yourself into this type of an inequity. And so therefore, by the time people of color were able to afford a house in Pittsburgh, it was unaffordable. And we want to make sure that to say we can't stop you from actually buying this house now, because as of that FHA act that was passed. So what we did is we just made sure our zoning laws kept our house prices expensive enough that nobody can purchase them that were locked out before. Because if you're locked out for that entire period, that means that people that bought these homes at a reasonable amount of money had some growth and appreciation in the home. So now by having one house per acre, one house per half acre, we set our house prices at such a level that it makes it almost impossible for people of color who have been locked out and disenfranchised financially from housing, which is one of the major assets for most families. So it's had a huge impact. Today in Pittsburgh, we have less than 2% African Americans living here. That is a direct result of us essentially keeping black people out of Pittsburgh, and we're still doing it today. It's a different name now. It's called exclusionary zoning laws. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much for that summation, Kevin. I want to take another call here from Emma on line two. Emma in Rochester, you have a question that's on my list of questions, so go ahead.
Oh, I beat you to it. Okay. Yes, hi. So just full disclosure, I'm actually Connor's sister. I'm not a plant. I just thought that I had I'm listening and I had a question and I was like, he's very busy with all this and maybe like the best way to get an answer is to call on the show. But I thought,
Connor, you need to work on your familial relations here. If the only way your own sister can get in touch with you is by calling the radio show, you need to get grounded here. Okay. All right. Emma, go ahead.
That is of course totally a joke. I'm wondering for homeowners who were alarmed by this, an obvious step is to find out if there is a covenant on your home and to maybe, figure out how to get that removed or how to, maybe put like a progressive type of thing about fair and equal housing or diverse housing onto your housing contract. But once you take that step, for people who want to be more kind of progressive or proactive about this, like what's the next natural thing you can do to bring attention to this or to move this forward with maybe some of the more entrenched issues that still exist in our community today?
Okay, good question, Emma. So the report does offer some solutions. Do you want to run them down, Connor, for us?
Happy to run through a bunch of them. So, and a lot of those, as Emma said, there are things that you can do to go down to the Monroe County Clerk's office, look through these things. In other communities, people have filed affidavits to put them into that chain of title. The chain of title is all the list of deeds and other documents related to your property. File an affidavit that disavows these things, right? That can be important. There's the history of folks using anti-racist covenants, groups of neighbors coming together to similarly do what racial covenants did, have a group of neighbors say, we're going to enforce a rule that says, instead of saying we ban black and brown people from living in this home, we want black and brown people here because we're going to promise not to discriminate. So there's all these things that can be done. But the important thing for people to understand is that it takes systemic change to actually address these things. And it's more important, it can be more important to address the effects of racial covenants, like exclusionary zoning, like the spread of racist ideas, like the increase in the racial wealth gap. And I want to make clear the increase in the racial wealth gap is because of the inflated property values white homeowners had and because of the direction of federal mortgage insurance and subsidies to white people who had racial covenants on their homes. So we have to address those effects. And again, the report lays out a lot of different action items that individuals and organizations can do. But what's really important, I think, for callers to do is hold elected officials and organizations that historically participated in spreading, agreeing to, or making racial covenants accountable. And you know, the earlier caller was talking about the systemic nature of that, of racism. And it's so important to realize all of the leaders and organizations that did this here. You know, Kodak, the Democrat and Chronicle,
well,
the Catholic Diocese
right,
of Rochester.
Right,
let's, and we can talk about that next.
Right. Let's not get too far ahead, but let's talk about some of those. Let's talk about some of these solutions. All right. So the county clerks could put a cover letter on all publicly issued deeds explaining and disavowing racial covenants. That's one of the potential solutions you offer. That's more of an educational step. Do I have that right, Connor?
That's right. That's okay. Right. Educating, you know, again, fighting those now, racist ideas out there.
Now, homeowners could hire a lawyer to wipe out the language. That can be expensive. And aren't deeds typically difficult to change?
You know, they can be. And that's not to say there can be things done now, but that's why it's very, very important for state legislatures to act to remove whatever barriers exist. And we've seen, you know, states across the country pass anti-covenant bills. And there's reasons to think that further steps can be taken, that those bills aren't enough. But here's the important thing. New York hasn't acted. We lag far behind other communities across the country in addressing racial covenants. And so we need legislators to act now. And there's been a bill proposed many, many times over the last decade that's never gotten passed. And so that's an important first step, is improving that bill and getting it passed.
Connor, let's hold that thought. I've got to take a break. It's the shortest break in radio, as your regular host, Evan Dawson, likes to say. So stay with us, and we'll be back with more Connections in just a moment.
I'm Megan Mack. Coming up in our second hour, we continue our series of conversations with local superintendents about their district's reopening plans. We'll hear from the superintendents of East Irondequoit and Churchville-Chilai Central School Districts about their learning models for the fall and their policies related to physical distancing, testing, masking, and more. They'll answer our questions and yours next hour.
You're listening to Connections. I'm David Andrietta, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about racial covenants, those insidious clauses in land deeds that for decades served to prevent people of color, Jews, other minorities, anyone commonly seen as non-white, from buying property, often in the most desirable neighborhoods. That these covenants existed isn't necessarily news, but the extent to which they were pervasive in Monroe County is, thanks to a new study conducted jointly by the Environmental Protection Clinic at Yale Law School and the City Roots Community Land Trust here in Rochester. Before the break, we were talking about the difficulty of removing this language from your deed if you happen to come across it. And I should say at this point, listeners, if you'd like to call the show, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994, or you can email us at connections@WXXI.org. We have phone lines are lighting up here. This is obviously a fascinating topic for a lot of people, and you may have questions about how to find these things, what you can do about them. You can listen in or feel free to call. So we were talking before the break about the difficulty in removing some of this language. And you talked about Connor Reynolds talked about how other states have passed these these anti-covenant laws, if you will, that to get rid of this the language in these deeds. California pushed for a law that would have forced the removal of deeds racist language. Every time a home was sold in the state, the Los Angeles Times reported, and this is a quote, "The bill has run into stiff opposition from real estate agents, title insurance companies, and county recorders who complain that it would be expensive and create a bureaucratic nightmare that could slow real estate transactions to little purpose since the covenants are already illegal." And I believe at the time, that was in the late 2000s, the governor was Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he vetoed the bill, saying that he appreciated its spirit, but didn't want to impose the expense of it. Your thoughts on that, Shane?
Yeah, I think, to me, that's really sad that was the approach. I think that these deed companies, like the one in Monroe County, that was run by Fred Hill and Frank Drum, and were responsible for many of these deeds. I mean, they profited handsomely from this. And these are the people that are still running these kind of organizations and profiting off of it. And I think they probably should spend a little bit more to make sure that people know what was in their deeds and know that this is officially illegal. I've been really inspired by Brian Stevenson with the Equal Justice Institute and the Museum Against Lynching in Montgomery. And he has this really great quote that I think is really huge and something that we haven't really done in Rochester. He says, "We have to commit to truth-telling first. You can't jump to reconciliation or solution until you tell the truth. You don't have to go outside your own institutions. You can begin by your own truth-telling." And I think when it comes to real estate in Rochester, we really haven't told the truth about redlining and about racial deed restrictions and how many thousands of them there are. People know these are on their deeds. They just don't talk about it. And I think we need to make sure that kids are educated about it, neighborhoods are educated about it, so that groups like City Roots Land Trust that believe housing is a human right can come together to push back and actually help people who have been prevented from home ownership have that same access. And I think that reparation, like Rich was saying in his call, has to be a huge piece of that. And one tiny part of that could be reparation in terms of that process of making sure that these deeds are changed are covered up.
So on that note, Shane, this was an interesting mm-hmm. take from someone from the Mapping Prejudice Project in Minneapolis, which did a project like this a number of years ago. This is Kirsten Delagarde, a founder of that project, which I believe was one of the first outfits to take on a project like this. And I saw her quoted in a CNN story saying this, quote, "My hope isn't that we erase the language. My hope is that we use this language as a launch pad for making restitution." Is that something that's possible? Who wants to take that?
I think so. I'll take just the beginning and let Kevin go. But
Shane?
Oh, yeah.
Shane Wiegand.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely possible. I think making it clear for people that this is on the deed, we don't want to erase it. We don't want that to go away, for sure. I think it's really important, and it's a part of that truth-telling process that can lead to change.
But if it remains on the deed, I mean, doesn't it then just sort of fester?
I like the idea of crossing it out personally, of crossing it out so you can see that it's there, but it's been crossed out. I know that's been done in places where the cover sheet that has that warning on the top of it. I'm in favor of something like that probably the most.
Kevin, how about you? Kevin Beckford?
I would agree. And I'll tell you why. If you think about what's been done with our history, it's been erased. Right. And because of that, we now have generations of young people that have been educated. And I'll pick on Pittsford here for a second. My wife was born and grew up here in Pittsford. She grew up in the neighborhood right outside of Oak Hill. She never knew why there were no black people in her neighborhood until the early 70s. She had no idea. Why? Because we didn't teach it. We erased it from our history. So I believe that the covenants, I love Shane's idea of crossing it out so you can see it and know that that's there. And then but here's the action, and I want to make sure I drive this home for anybody listening to the show today that lives in Pittsford. We have a role and responsibility. We, out of all the suburbs, we did the worst in terms of making sure that this worked to keep black people out of Pittsford, to the extent that right now the property values have grown to the point where people of color and average household incomes doesn't afford them the opportunity to be able to purchase homes in Pittsford easily, and we're still doing it today.
Priced out of the neighborhood.
Yes, but here's a good thing, and here's a good news. We just passed a comp plan last year. I tried to get some language in it to make an affirmative statement that we wanted to sit down with landowners, developers, to have the right level of density in our zoning laws, or more inclusionary zoning laws, to allow for condos, apartments, townhomes, and patio homes that were targeting folks on the opposite end, the under 100,000, versus what we're doing today. Every new neighborhood we build, that we started to build, they started 400, 500, 600 or more. And it's because those exclusionary zoning laws puts one house per acre, one house per half acre, and they're building essentially mega mansions, right?
Right,
And so what you can do today is that the good news is I wasn't successful at 14. I didn't have enough votes to get it to pass. In fact, it was a very good time for having a conversation as a community. But here's what's nice. The thing is that when we get ready to change those zoning laws, we still can change it the way that makes sense to us.
Good.
So we just hired a law firm that's going to be helping us to rewrite our zoning laws. We will let all of you know in Pittsburgh. It'll be because we have to make public announcements around it. I want you to show up. And if you feel strongly about what we did wrongly and historically, I need you to show up and to tell us on the board, we need you to make more inclusionary zoning laws to right this wrong and to open up Pittsburgh so it's much more accessible to all humans and not just ones that we feel that should be living there.
That is Kevin. That is Kevin Beckford, a Pittsburgh Town Board member. We're going to take a call now from Keita on line 3. Keita, thank you for listening to the program and calling in. What do you have to say?
Hi, everybody. I'm a middle school teacher, and your work is really empowering me to better teach local history. I appreciate your team shining a light on this inequity, especially here in Rochester. It surfaces choices that individuals made to act in a racist manner, and also shows the opportunity for us to act in an anti-racist manner regarding housing or in all our interactions, really, going forward. Thanks.
Thanks, Keita. And if you're not familiar with it, Shane Wiegand has been working for a long time on an anti-racist curriculum that is really gaining some traction in Monroe County. City News wrote about it recently. I know it's gotten some other press. You might want to just check it out if you're not familiar with it. I want to turn to line 4. We've got Tom in Rochester who says that he has one of these racial covenants on his deed. Tom, are you with us?
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for calling in. So tell us what you did about it. Tell us what you found and what you did about it, if anything.
Well, you had me digging through my poorly organized paperwork because I knew that I had, when I purchased my house, I obtained copies of the abstract history for the property. And I knew that in there was a covenant. It looks like from 1911, and the wording is subject to conditions and restrictions that premises shall not be sold or leased to colored people or Italians.
It almost makes your stomach turn to read it out loud,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think it might be illuminating to a lot of people to realize that until fairly recently, Italians were not considered white. A lot of people might be surprised to learn that.
So what did you do about this language, if anything?
Well, I'm not finding it right now, but I know that in this history, and I think it wasn't until like the early 60s that this covenant was lifted. I'm not sure what the terminology is, but, you know, was negated. And it's in this paperwork somewhere, but it's, you know, you have to kind of really go through with a fine-tooth comb to find some.
Out of curiosity, did it ever give you pause at the time? When did you buy your home?
2008.
Okay. Did it ever give you pause that this was in there, you know, in buying the home? I mean, it's unenforceable.
I bought the home, but it's also my home is in the 19th Ward, which has its own history in regards to redlining. So, I mean, I knew that this property could legally be sold to anybody, you know. And I knew that this, that these sorts of covenants existed. But it was interesting to see that, you know, on the house that I had just purchased, this was something that, that it had existed.
Thanks. Thank you, Tom.
You bet.
Thank you for sharing. We have an email from Jillian. She wants to know whether Irondequoit was included in this study. If so, what's the history on the matter? And is there a difference between the east and west part of town? Shane or Connor, you want to take that?
I'll start with that. Irondequoit is huge. We have the most racially restrictive covenants in Irondequoit, several thousand, especially in northwest Irondequoit, in the Somerville area and all by the Seneca Park Zoo, around the Irondequoit High School. The county supervisor himself, Clarence Smith, put racial deed restrictions, limiting only people of the Caucasian race from living there, and also in the area over by the Irondequoit Bay. Irondequoit, more than anywhere else, really, really rough stuff.
Let's talk about, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to follow up. Irondequoit is one of the places where Monroe County itself put racial covenants onto deeds. You know, the entire county legislature voted to do this. And, you know, that's kind of north of the city. On the west side of the city, you got the town of Gates and the Gates School District that agreed to use these racial covenants to keep Black and brown people out of their community.
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go. Yeah. I wanted to go here, Connor, because we talked about this earlier. I mean, who wrote these things? How were they granted? I mean, the research suggests that developers, real estate agent, bankers could, you know, wrote these things in. But could anyone ask for one of these covenants? How were they granted? And I just want to say, you know, your report refers to the presidents of the Monroe County Bar Association, the Home Builders Association of Rochester president included them in deeds that they wrote. Monroe County did it, as you mentioned, in Irondequoit, did it in Gates. The Gates Central School District did it. The Catholic Diocese of Rochester bought these properties. Walter Wegman, one of the founders of Wegmans, bought these properties. These were the muckety-mucks. These were the heavy hitters of Monroe County. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. Pretty much the entire power structure in Monroe County in the early 20th century acted to use racial covenants to intentionally segregate our communities. And there's really two ways you could do it. Either a developer could come in, own the land, and then when is it selling an entire subdivision or parcels of the land, put these on each one of the agreements. And that's something that Monroe County did when it was selling off a bunch of land in Irondequoit. The other way to do it was to have neighbors who were living together decide to all agree after they bought their homes to put racial covenants on. That's what the town of Gates and the Gates School District
So that too. That would have to be like a neighborhood decision. It couldn't be an individual decision like you're – You know, someone buys a home in, you know, 1938. It doesn't have a racial covenant. They couldn't insist that one go on, or could they?
It's you know, the power of racial covenants is communal enforcement. It's all about communal enforcement. So you could put this on your home, but property law doesn't allow it to stick with the home through generations unless it's a group of people enforcing it. That's an important thing to understand.
Oh, that is really important to understand.
Mm-hmm. And it's all the more reason why when people are thinking about what to do, you can't just think about individual action. You have to think about communal action, including, again, holding these institutions historically that have participated in this accountable. And I just want to say, you know, that fantastic DNC article that came out that Justin Murphy had, he got quotes from lots of different people talking about what needed to be done. And none of those quotes, some of them said, you know, this was bad, we feel awful. None of them said we're going to commit to doing something about it by funding the organizations that are fighting for housing equity, fighting, you know, the modern, what scholars call the modern racial covenant, which is pro-segregation, anti-Black policing. You know, there's so much that actually needs to get done. And right now we've just, for most organizations, just heard words. And that's just simply not enough. So people need to push people in power today to do more.
Is apologizing enough?
You know,
I ask because I want to jump in on that Democrat and Chronicle article. I agree, it was very thorough, and I was impressed that the Democrat and Chronicle, and specifically the editor Michael Killian, addressed this in the article by apologizing on behalf of the paper for something that it did in 1928.
I wonder if I could weigh in real quick on that question. So I think apologizing is certainly a good start because I think it needs to be acknowledged. You know, I think the thing that's missed in some of the discussion around racism is a fundamental flaw in the thinking, is that what it's based on is that people of color and African Americans are not fully human. So, and that sounds powerful, but that is the only way you can talk yourself into these inequities. And so, for example, the instrument of deed and covenant restrictions didn't just appear. It was because if you don't believe someone's fully human, that's the reason why they were able to think of it being okay to say, I don't want you living next to me or your kid going to school next to my kid. And in fact, and I need to touch on something that Rich mentioned that called in earlier. There's never been a study that's shown that when a black person moves into a neighborhood that your property values goes down. That was a racist idea that was then followed with a racist action of putting deed and covenant restrictions to say, we don't want you to move here because our property values will go down. That is not only not true, it makes no sense at all. In fact, all it essentially did was locked out African Americans from being able to be fully franchised into the American dream.
Kevin, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes here, and I want to take another call on line one. We've got Louise in, I believe it's Louise in Rochester. Do I have that right?
Yep.
Yes, you do.
Okay, thank you. You've been on hold a long time, so thank you for being patient.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. I just want to say also, you know, I am a daughter of immigrant parents from Italy, and both of them passed, so it's years ago. And when they were married, they could only rent on Jefferson Ave and then Joseph Ave, and that went on for quite a while. They thought they had made it big when they got to, you know, Meg Street. So they went through all that as well, and also a lot of hatred when neighbors found out about their last name. But what I'm experiencing is I live in the South Wedge, and I've owned my home for 25 years. And this has been a targeted area to push out black and brown people. I moved here because it was so diverse and so beautiful, and I could walk down and see all sorts of cultures. And they are being pushed out, and so is low income, so it's really important to talk about class. I am also being pushed out because for the third time in 8 years, the assessment rollout has unfairly assessed our homes on a little one-way street on Diem.
Yeah, city assessments went up 19% across the board, and South Wedge was one of those that was north of 19%. Louise, thank you so much for the call.
I know you're at the end of the show. Thank you, dear.
I want to make sure that anyone who is interested in finding their deed can figure out how to do that. It's actually really quite easy if you go to monroecounty.gov. That is the county website. And, you know, it's kind of a busy website, but if you look down to on the right-hand side, you'll see a little link to Search County Clerk Records. From there, you have to become a member. It doesn't cost you anything. As a reporter, I search these records all the time, so I have a membership I've registered, and it's really, really very, very easy. And you can also go down to your county clerk's office and ask for help. Are there any other ways people could do this that I'm not touching on?
David, I think that you can find your deed online, but you don't always have access to all of it because the records are only from the 1970s or 80s on that are digitized. So you really have to take the most updated version of your deed. You can go down to the clerk's office and find your original deed on a microfilm. And the folks at the clerk's office are super helpful and will help out. I do want to make one quick point about what the caller said about the South Wedge and Italian folks and Jewish folks. It was in 1944 with the passage of the GI Bill that those people officially became white and had access to the GI and FHA mortgages, whereas people of color who had served in the war didn't have that same access. And so there was this legal distinction that may have allowed her family to make it to Meg Street or the South Wedge. But that gentrification in the South Wedge is exactly why we need organizations like City Roots Community Land Trust and properties owned by the community land trusting community to prevent that kind of increase in appraisal and appreciation that I think is so important to keeping a neighborhood stable and the people who live there from being displaced.
Shane, thank you so much. Unfortunately, We've got to close out here. This has been a really scintillating conversation. This report is eye-opening, confronting racial covenants, how they segregated Monroe County and what to do about them. 58 pages. Google searches will find it. No problem. I want to thank my guest, Kevin Beckford, Pittsford Town Board member. Thank you so much for your insight on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Shane Wieken, board member of the Rochester-based City Roots Community Land Trust and one of the organizations that conducted this racial covenant study. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you, David. I want to close with a quote from my fourth grader. If kids and people learn about these covenants, maybe when they're older, they'll change segregation in Rochester. And that's my hope.
Thank you. Connor Dwyer Reynolds, a clinical lecturer at Yale Law School and a lead researcher on the study. Thank you so much for joining us. And I especially want to thank...
Thanks for being here. I need to call my sister. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, you do. You do. Make that call. Thank you for joining us today. And a very special thank you to Rob Braden, the engineer for Connections, and Megan Mack, the show's producer, for holding my hand through the entire broadcast. Thank you so much.